Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. And today with me on the podcast is Cheryl Hung. She's VP Ecosystem at the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, in short, CNCF. And the special thing about this episode, actually, that I'm speaking to my first female guest on the podcast. I'm very proud. It's a bit sad, to be honest. I want to change that. So if you, maybe Cheryl, have a few recommendations or other listeners have recommendations for female guests, please tell me, please approach me. Talking about CNCF, it's a sub-organization of the Linux Foundation, which was founded in 2015. And the idea is that the ecosystem of container technology has to be pushed by this foundation, or that's the idea, that this foundation pushes container technology such as Docker. It has, I think, around 200 members. And I think that's exactly your job, right? To manage the whole ecosystem of open source projects that are in the CNCF Foundation, and also get new members and stuff like that. Is that correct?
First of all, hi Toby. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's really great to be here, especially as the first female guest. Secondly, the way that CNCF is structured is we have the open source projects, so Kubernetes, Prometheus, Envoy, many others, and we've hit just over 100 of those projects as of July 2021. And then separately to that, we have the members. So those are the companies that fund the organization and keep it going. And of those members, we have over 600 now, in fact.
Wow.
And then about 150 of those are end user companies, and they form the end user community, which I lead. So the end users are companies who are adopting cloud native, like Spotify and MasterCard and Apple, but they don't sell any kind of cloud native services or products themselves. So that's generally how we split up the foundation.
And those company partly also contribute open source, right? I think Zalando is a member. I used to work for Zalando, actually.
Oh, nice. And Zalando are great.
Yeah, I guess they also contribute, right? They contribute as they have a very nice cloud team.
Yes, they're very really good people over at Zalando. We really encourage all of the companies, but especially the end user companies, to be a part of the open source community in whatever way they can be. So some companies are a bit further down the line, a bit more advanced, a bit more mature. So they are the ones who are typically contributing directly to the open source projects, as in submitting pull requests on GitHub and actually being part of the open source projects themselves. But we also really welcome the stories, case studies around companies that are using cloud native. And what are the challenges they ran into? How did they overcome them? You know, what would they recommend to other people? So we just try and encourage people to get involved in whatever way they can.
and talk about what they do and how, or just contribute code, right? It's quite an interesting job, especially if you look at the typical question, like as a female, how did you, as a girl, how did you end up in that job? I'm interested, what is your nerd path? I mean, it's kind of unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you could say that. I don't think I realized how unusual it was at the beginning, maybe. I was a teenager, probably 13, 14, when I decided that I really wanted to be a software engineer at Google. That was my goal. I knew from pretty early on. And I was at that age, I was, you know, playing around with JavaScript and building terrible web pages and that sort of thing. But I really, you know, Google was this really up and coming startup at that time. It was really hot. It was doing all these cool things with technology. And I knew they gave you free food. And I was like, cool, this sounds like a company that I want to work at. So everything I did from then on was really with the goal in mind that I wanted to go work at Google, be a software engineer. So I studied computer science, and I was lucky enough to join Google at the age of 21. And I spent my 5 years there working on Google Maps, building backend features, mainly as a C++ programmer, and then a little bit later moving into program management as well. So for me, it was always very clear that I really wanted to go into technology as a career and be a software engineer. After Google, in fact, I left Google in 2015, and that was just about when containers and Docker and Kubernetes a couple of years later were starting to come up again. And because at Google I was using Borg was the internal version of what would later become Kubernetes, I was already very familiar with containers and building this kind of large scale infrastructure. So once I left Google and I looked around at what else was out there, I decided that what I really wanted to do was bring that style of building large-scale, reliable, distributed infrastructure out to the rest of the world and help other companies and help other people adopt it as well.
But your job as of today is a bit less nerdy than at the beginning, right? I mean, if you started as C++ engineer, that's like kind of the nerdiest, almost the nerdiest thing you can do these days. And then you ended up in management quite quickly. Do you every once in a while still develop software?
I like to play with little things for myself. I only build projects for myself nowadays. And you know, sometimes it is a bit sad, you know, when you spend such a long time, you have this dream, you really work for it, and you get that. And then after a while, you start to think, okay, well, what is next? Because I can't stick with my 14-year-old's dream forever. You have to go and find something else that you can do, some other way that you can bring value to the world and do something useful in the world. So yeah, nowadays I see myself as kind of within the sphere of technology for sure, still very technical. I still enjoy learning a lot about technology and playing with different things. But day to day, yeah, I don't code anymore.
Yeah, but you're an open source advocate, right? And that is kind of a very cool job to have, right? That you can convince others and also... every once in a while, I guess you're on a stage, which I think is very important for diversity as well. I mean, it's hard. We already discussed that in the pre-discussion we had. To get people into the podcast, but also to have role models, right? It's very important. And if you are hiding as a software manager somewhere, or software developer somewhere, It's maybe not the best that can be done for diversity.
I think that software engineers in general, not even talking about diversity, tend to have this feeling that we just need to focus on code. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as we build good stuff, you know, everything else is not as important, not important compared to building good code. And I made a very conscious move that I wanted to move into advocacy, and I wanted to go out there and I wanted to present and I wanted to do a lot of public speaking. I wish we could be on stage. Obviously, I haven't done any of that in the last year. But I do think it's really important for people to not only be able to build high quality software and do good work, but also to be able to communicate that to other people and to show off what they're doing. And when I was actually a developer advocate formerly at a startup called StorageOS, I was looking around for different meetups that I could use to speak at. And I was looking for cloud native meetups in particular. And I found there was a cloud native Berlin and a cloud native Paris, and there wasn't one in London. So I thought, let me just start one and see if anyone shows up, see if anyone's interested in this. So I just picked a date, like 2 months into the future. I didn't have speakers, didn't have a venue, completely didn't exist at all. And the very first meetup that I ran, we had 110 people show up.
Wow, that's great.
So I was like, okay, there's definitely interest here. There's, you know, definitely something that we can bring to the community in London. And then ever since then, I've run it for the last 4 years, and I really, really encourage people to come up and speak. I encourage diverse speakers. I encourage women. I encourage first-time speakers, because I do think it is really important for us to, as you say, to see these role models and to see other people up there who we can go, well, like, I think it would be cool if I could talk about what I'm doing. Often people are very nervous about it, so I try and tell them, you know, you just need to go out there and share your story. Mm. You don't need to be a world-class expert in every single technology before you can talk about it. So it is something I'm very passionate about.
That's great. That's great. I like it. And you won an award by the end of last year. I read the Tech Women 100 Award. That's also great, right? That you actually became a role model there as well. And I read that under your guidance, your community has grown by 90% year on year. I guess that's last year, right? Is that correct?
Over the last 2 years.
Over the last two years. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, well, thank you, first of all. Yeah, the Tech Women 100 was definitely a big honor for me to receive that award. And secondly, it's kind of strange to me because I didn't really have any role models in that sense when I was, I suppose, studying and early in my career as an engineer. So it's a little bit strange for me now to think of this idea as myself as a role model. But I really do try and reach out to people and say, you know, at the end of the day, we're all humans. We're all trying to do our best and trying to work hard and do what we can. So your role models are not like far away, distant people. They are people that you can talk to and you can get to know as well.
Okay. And how does your daily job look like? It's a bit hard to imagine.
Probably like a lot of people's at the moment, which is email, Slack, meetings. I think what I try and keep in mind, my overall mission, as I said it for myself, is I want to make sure that end users can be productive and successful as they're adopting cloud native. So a lot of my time I spend with the community, talking to them, figuring out what are the issues that they're facing now, figuring out how I can not that I try and solve them for people, because CNCF is a vendor neutral organization. We specifically cannot say, you know, you should use this vendor over this vendor or use this product over this product. But we do try and say, like, okay, if you are a large company and you're looking at issues with, I don't know, running ML pipelines, then maybe I know another large company who's also running like ML pipelines, and maybe there are some things that you can discuss and figure out a common solution. So yeah, a lot of what I do is just managing the different kind of community, trying to keep the industry moving forward, try and keep the open source projects happy, the project maintainers. Yeah, so it is a very different work style from a typical programmer, engineer.
I think like part of your work is also the tech radar that you hand out, right? Is that guiding organizations which tool is in which state and how potentially useful for a company of a certain size, or what is the idea behind that?
Yeah, Tech Radar is something that I'm actually very proud of at CNCF. And the story of how it started is about a year ago, so Q1 in 2020, just as the pandemic was kicking off, really. I got talking to some people from the community, some of them from end users, some people on the technical oversight committee at CNCF, some people on the governing board. And the thing that I kept hearing over and over again was, we really want to hear from end users what they really think about cloud native. Like, let's cut through the hype. Let's cut through the marketing. Like, what is the actual reality of cloud native? So this is actually quite a difficult question to ask, because there's tens of thousands, I don't know, maybe even hundreds of thousands of companies now, and definitely hundreds of thousands of people who are using cloud native. And how do you figure out how to condense all of their thoughts and what they're thinking about into a format that's easy to understand and has something kind of substantial behind it, right? It's not just opinion. It's not Cheryl's opinion of what's happening in cloud native, but it truly reflects the actual experience. So I did a lot of research around companies like Gartner and Forrester, the kind of reports that they put out. So the Tech Radar was a way to find out what technologies are the most mature, which ones are up and coming, and which ones people are moving away from, or, you know, they're starting to fade away. And to use the end user community that I run and survey them and ask them basically what are their thoughts about certain different topics. So as I said, I'm very proud of what we've actually achieved with this. We've now run we publish one report every quarter. They take about 10 to 12 weeks to produce. So it takes us, we do about one every quarter. And the feedback that I've had from it is great. Like, I've had companies say to us, like, well, when we're looking at, I don't know, database storage, or when we look at continuous deployment, like, we will use these radars internally with our own management to figure out what we should be using right now and what everybody else is using. So it's really seen great adoption and had great feedback.
It's actually great to see that coming from a foundation, as you are per definition neutral. I mean, Gartner is also kind of neutral. I would think. But if you look at then like the review communities out there or review platforms out there, it starts just getting influenced by vendors and so on. And I like the idea to, or there's potential for manipulation, at least let's phrase it like that. I like the idea of seeing that coming from an independent foundation.
It's also difficult to get the true sense of open source from a company like Gartner, because they mainly focus on vendor tools and technologies. They don't focus as much on open source. And so that was one of the other goals with the CNCF Technology Radar, was to understand, you know how open source is. It gets massively complicated. There are thousands and thousands of tools now. And to try and really focus on the open source part of it. I mean, we include vendor tools as well, but to really illuminate how people really use open source. And people should definitely check this out. By the way, you can go to radar.cncf.io and read all of our past reports.
Okay, cool. But I think a lot of open source projects also are commercialized after a while, right? I mean, looking at MongoDB or Elastic or others, at a certain time, they started becoming publicly listed.
And this is not a bad thing.
No, no. It's a good thing. I think because sometimes you have to form a professional organization around something. And I think, especially if you look at those tools, I mean, Elastic, like the main contributor is still the founder of Elastic, I think, if you look at GitHub. And I think it's natural that there has to be something economically, some reward for that, because it's great software, right?
We tend to think of it at CNCF as making sure these open source projects are sustainable. So make sure that the people who work on it get paid, have a good lifestyle, and can continue to work on the open source projects for as long as they can. Because if you go back, you know, 20 years ago, maybe even not that long, the vast majority of open source projects were one, two people working in their spare time in the evenings and the weekends. And it was a passion project. You know, they loved working on it, but at some point, you can't throw infinite amounts of time into something that, you know, takes time away from other things. So yeah, the way that we think about it is the maintainers who are working on the open source projects typically form companies around them. Those companies capture some of the, commercialize it, capture some of the value, and then some of that value goes back into the next round of open source projects and supporting the next round of maintainers.
Okay, so that is a great thing to do, actually. Speaking of containers, what do you think about the future of containers? So how will it look like in, let's say, 5 to 10 years from now?
Wow, that is a long time, 5 to 10 years. How long have containers been around now? Let's say since 2013, 2014?
I think around 10 years, right? And I think looking at that time span, it kind of developed. But if I look at, let's say, my Mac and how Kubernetes for Mac evolved, or Docker for Mac especially evolved, it doesn't feel like two big steps, right? Or two big jumps. What do you think will happen? Will it be integrated at a certain time more deeply into the operating systems, or what is the next step?
Yeah. So first of all, a very interesting conversation trend that I've seen is I now talk to university students who have never deployed software in anything other than a container. You know, for them, containers is not the new thing or an alternative way to do something. It is the only way they know how to download software. You know, they get it from Docker Hub using the Docker command line, which I think is wonderful. I think is quite a surprise to us who've been around and still think of containers as something that's maybe not new, but, you know, it's not the only way to do things. So I do think that is wonderful. I think it's a sign of the way of the future. The other trend that I see is that containers are moving into more and more different areas. So right now, I would say if you're deploying something like a web scale application, you'll probably use containers for it. Even if you have some enterprise software that used to run on VMs or used to run on bare metal, it's actually not hard to move that into a container. So a lot of that work, I think, is easy and has already been done. If you're talking about, say, running containers on IoT devices or on the edge, like, that is still quite new, I think. And there's still a few years of growth left for containers into those kinds of areas.
It's actually impressive that this happened, right? I mean, that if you own a Raspberry Pi and you install some home automation software, then most likely in the background you have Docker and it's all running in containers. It's hard. What was hard to imagine 5 years ago.
It's astonishing. I mean, it's really changed so fast. I do feel a little bit for Docker, the company, because they did have this great technology. It was founded around open source. And I think they struggled a little bit with properly monetizing and commercializing that. But the value of the technology is definitely there. Just Docker as a company is not as hot as it used to be.
It's hard to monetize as it's mostly around like individual engineers and monetizing individual engineers is relatively hard. I mean, and then you can go to the cloud providers and negotiate with them. And that's where it gets hard if you initially came up with a free software and so on, I guess.
That is true. Individual developers generally don't like to pay for software, surprisingly. It was always going to be difficult to get individual people to pay. And then, as you say, with the big cloud providers, negotiating with Docker is just, it was a different scale. You know, it's quite a challenge.
And what do you think about Kubernetes in general? I mean, you are a Kubernetes foundation. The CNCF was initially formed around Kubernetes, I think. Where do you see Kubernetes in a few years?
So I love Kubernetes, right? First of all,
me as well.
but Kubernetes, I think, also has had an extremely fast explosion of adoption. Even 3 years ago, sort of 2018, 2017, there were still quite a few viable alternatives to Kubernetes. You know, people were looking at Docker Swarm and Rancho and HashiCorp's Nomad, and the different cloud providers quite often had their own managed services as well. And all of that has kind of faded away, and we have now left with Kubernetes is the base layer if you're running this kind of orchestrated platforms.
Well, if you run locally, you sometimes still have Docker Compose, right? Because you can then mount your file system and so on. Do you think that will disappear as well, or?
I don't think it will disappear. Let me go back a little bit in time and tell a story about Borg, which I think also applies to Kubernetes. We used to have this saying at Google that Borg makes it very difficult to run one of anything, but very easy to run 10,000 of it. And I think the same is true of Kubernetes. You know, if you need to learn Kubernetes, the complexity to learn it and to get onboarded and to build one application or one service is pretty high. You need to invest a lot of time. But then once you have it running once, you can scale it really easily. So I think there is still space there for something where you don't want to spend 6 months learning the concepts of Kubernetes and getting someone, spending a lot of time to learn the concepts before you can start running something small locally.
Mm-hmm. And you think that is also space that is soon filled up with Kubernetes as well? Because that is, like, also from my perspective, the learning curve is in a way still a large barrier, right? And that is the space which now cloud providers try to fill up with platform as a service, which is in a way a competitor to Kubernetes in a lot of cases. Do you think this will be space that soon to be occupied by Kubernetes?
There's a couple of different initiatives and a couple of different tools as well, like Minikube, which make it possible to run Kubernetes, a small Kubernetes cluster locally. But I don't think that actually running it is the difficult bit. I think that understanding the interactions and the different components, that I think will always take time, no matter, you know, no matter how fast it is to spin up a cluster on, you know, Google Cloud, like you still need to understand what to do with it from then on.
Yeah, right. That's in a way hard to understand that if you just want to run your WordPress locally, you need, I don't know, a pod, a few containers, a bridge to the database, a service, an ingress, and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you need so much. Like, we got to remember that for a lot of people, they're still very new to the idea of containers, even. And Kubernetes is very, very, very new. So even as someone who's worked in this space for a while, I really definitely recognize there's a lot of complexity in, even in the early stages of Kubernetes, of running Kubernetes. And then kind of the further you go, the more complex it gets, because now you have to add some kind of observability framework, and you need to add security to it, and you need to figure out how to make your database highly available. And, you know, there's so many choices and so many things that you need to make a decision on.
Yeah. This episode is proudly presented by Dell Technologies. They are a team of experts that helps you solving all your IT-related challenges and IT needs in your daily business and consult you in choosing the right end-to-end IT solutions or products. They offer IT technology solutions for companies of any size, tailored to their needs, and have a huge product portfolio with IT solutions and know-how. They can help CTOs through providing end-to-end IT solutions, be it laptops, PCs, workstations, or server, storage, cloud, and IoT solutions or financing. If you want to know more, please check the show notes to get a link. And as soon as you deal with databases, for example, as soon as your project is no longer ephemeral and everything can be deleted and you have state, it gets harder, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I come from a storage background. Before I joined CNCF, I was at a storage startup that was building product called StorageOS. It was persistent storage for containers and Kubernetes. So I have a particular affection, shall we say, for storage and running stateful applications. Actually, I joined that company in 2017, beginning of 2017. And I thought that within about 18 months, this would be a solved problem. And we're now 4 years later, and I would say it's still not a solved problem. So maybe I was optimistic at that time. But I do think I've started to see more and more companies and organizations embracing running the stateful applications within their containerized infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, you have to say there's no alternative, right? I mean, you can still stick with bare metal, but or use a platform. Yeah. Use a platform, obviously.
I mean, I used to say that, like, there is no such thing as a stateless application. You know, if you're doing something useful, you're going to have to store data somewhere. And that means you have to make a decision about it. You know, even if you've outsourced that to a cloud provider and said, I'm going to use, you know, RDS from AWS or something, like, that still comes with trade-offs and implications. So, yeah, you can't assume that. It's a really nice abstraction to say, you know, it can be ephemeral at the beginning, but at some point you still have to make a decision about storage.
Yeah, that's also an interesting, let's say, misconception in modern trends that you see out there. For example, Jamstack, you have those frameworks that just generate static web pages, and it's all fine. It's all like blazingly fast, but as soon as you need to, I don't know, write something, it gets harder, right?
And right, yeah. I mean, my own personal blog, I run it on Jekyll and GitHub Pages. And for static, anything static, it is fantastic. But for anything else that is not static, I end up integrating third-party services into it. You know, it's just not very well suited for anything dynamic. Yeah.
And as soon as you integrate third-party services, you can ask yourself, is it the right thing I do here, or should I just stick to, I don't know, WordPress and Cloudflare? That would be much simpler sometimes, right?
I think this is the nerd in me still. It's like, no, I built this. I can figure it out. I have affection for it, even though, as you say, WordPress and Cloudflare would probably be a nicer solution.
Potentially, yeah. I know that feeling. Yeah. I know that feeling. If you look at cloud native, what are the trends that you see rising in the near future?
I wrote a blog post about this recently, actually, which you can check out the whole thing on my blog, which is oicherl.com, oicherl.com, where I was thinking at the beginning of 2021 about what should we expect for the next year. Kind of divided the, I've made 10 predictions, dangerously, about cloud native. And I divided those into technology, frameworks, and tools, into kind of DevOps, things about people and processes, and then ecosystem, so wider trends across businesses and across the industry. So I definitely recommend, like, you should go check out the full list of the 10. But the kind of underlying theme behind all of it is that cloud native deployments are getting more and more complex. We're starting to see more specialization, and we're starting to see cloud native move into areas like edge, where previously we haven't seen very much of it before.
You mentioned edge now for the second time. And edge meaning like devices closer to the user. And we see like a lot of technology evolving there, like WebAssembly. Why do you think this is a complexity which is needed and which is trending so heavily?
Yeah, so as you say, edge refers to when you move computing closer to the user. So sometimes that is very, very close. That might be in the mobile phone that they're holding in their hand. Sometimes it might mean moving it to something which is, you know, 100 meters away, you know, something rather than a centralized cloud data center, which might be thousands of kilometers away. And the reason that we do it is because it gives better user experience for the user, right? You know, you can process things faster and get a better response to the user. But the challenge of this is all the things that we have come to rely on, you know, reliable networks, having security over, because, you know, you can control a physical data center, you can't control what happens on someone's device. We lose all of these assumptions when we move towards an edge model. So I would say, basically, to sum up for this, that the pressure is there to move to edge because it makes for better user experience. And fundamentally, that is what people want. But the challenges of that mean that we could actually take advantage of some of the concepts behind cloud native to solve some of those challenges. For example, you can very easily wrap a piece of software into a container, deploy that on one IoT device, test it, and then be reassured that you can deploy it to thousands of IoT devices at the same time. And that's very easy.
And that is the idea behind WebAssembly, right? That you build, in a way, micro containers that have an idea or are containerized, are secure by definition, and can run, for example, on, I had Tyler McMullen here from Fastly in the podcast, can run on Fastly's cloud, on Fastly's edge, in a way, right?
So WebAssembly, has part of that, but partly it's also about being able to run on web technologies that you wouldn't previously be able to do. So for example, using JavaScript, running things on a JavaScript virtual machine. So it just kind of, again, it's about expanding the different environments that you can run containers in.
Okay, so a Raspberry Pi was a good example for running containers on the edge in a way, right? But there are more.
For sure,
there are more
yeah.
and more companies like offering that edge computing as a service, and I think Fastly is one of them. Cloudflare is one of them. Mm-hmm. They just offer their network and their nodes so that you can run like micro containers on them, right?
Mm. I think this is still very, very early, very nascent technology. Mm. So far, I don't think I have seen it deployed at a large scale. Everything that I've seen so far seems to be quite small, but this is definitely one of the trends that we see happening over 2021 and probably a couple more years into the future.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, for example, switching something on the edge is kind of a nice one, right? If you, let's say you're at Cloudflare or Fastly or whatever other provider there, and you can just install an extension which just filters the traffic of your website, and you don't have anything to do with that. You can just install a security add-on, and then I don't know, scrapers are filtered out or something like that. And I guess that's the idea of them. And it's just very hard to explain if you come from traditional web apps where everything is happening on your servers, right?
Mm, that is a very neat example, actually. Yeah, it's a very cool example.
Yeah, I was searching for examples like for a while now. And it's very hard. If you talk to those guys, then yeah. You always hear very abstract things. And
yeah. Well, as you say as well, so much of cloud native is still built with the idea of it's some kind of a web service that you're building. So yeah, it's just hard to find examples of things where that's not the case.
Okay, but stepping back from cloud native and towards open source your job, how do you actually encourage companies to contribute to open source? Do you actually do that, or do you rather say, okay, you can be an end user, you can be a contributor, I don't mind, just be a member?
I mean, we definitely welcome anybody who wants to take part in any kind of capacity. But if a company has the willingness to contribute more, then we definitely try and support them in whatever way possible. So for example, with some companies, this really depends on the company. In some companies, there are legal hurdles that they need to overcome because perhaps their legal department doesn't have any kind of processes around open source, and they need to make sure that we need to go into their legal department and talk to them and help them figure it out. Sometimes it's because there's no internal champions for open source. People who can say, you know, open source is actually critical to our business. This is something we need to invest into, and someone who can support the individual engineers to do it. I find once people actually start getting into open source community work, like they can start contributing, no problem. But there's so much that needs to happen within the organization first before they can get to that point. And that's where we try and come in and help out where we can.
And I think it's also important to educate companies around the complexity of open source. I mean, in a way, it is a lot of effort, right? It is. I saw it at Zalando, for example. They are contributors and they have very nice open source projects, but I still see or saw how much effort it is to actually publish something. Is that the reason why you more and more see commercial open source publishers, because the quality turned out to be very important? Or
I don't know. I don't think it's so much about quality, but for end users, open source is not contributing to their business value directly. So it's harder to describe. You know, if you are if you are Adidas and you're selling shoes, any time that engineers are working on open source, in some way, takes time away from building infrastructure and building services that can be used to sell shoes and sporting goods and so on. So it's always a little bit more of a fight, as you say, when you have to educate companies and tell them that open source is not just something that you're doing because it's good, because it's nice to do, but because if you built your business on top of open source, it's really important that you have a say in these open source technologies. Like, you want them to be around for the next 5, 10, 20 years, just as Linux has. And it's important for you to get involved so that you can really determine the direction, the future direction, the technical direction of these projects.
How would you say would a company like Adidas profit from open source? Is it that they might have a better way to hire people that are really interested in their stuff? Is it because they can make a business out of it? Or what would it be from your perspective?
I see three main reasons why companies, particularly end user companies, get involved with open source. The first one is typically because they are looking to meet their peers who are doing similar work as them, and they want to understand how they've built their infrastructure and basically learn from each other and share what they're doing. The second, as you say, is to help with recruiting, because frankly, if you're a good developer, you can go so many places in the world right now. And most developers want to work somewhere where towards a company which is a good open source citizen, you know, supports open source and lets developers use some of their time in open source to contribute towards open source. And then thirdly, there are companies who are doing it for a more strategic reason. So sometimes that might be, as you say, because they want to build a new business unit around something. Typically, they have their own open source project and they want to release that to the community. Sometimes it's because they want to build a business unit or a new line of work around that open source project. And yeah, quite often it's because they've recognized that it is important for them to be involved in the technical direction of this infrastructure. So they want to put effort behind it. Mm-hmm.
I sometimes feel that like an engineer contributing to open source is also sometimes more into the quality of his work, because he or she knows that it's actually available for everyone and that everyone can check the code then. And it makes it a bit harder and the effort maybe a bit higher, but it's also a good reason to actually open source your stuff, right?
Mixed on the quality, I think. I've seen, you know, obviously you get things like Kubernetes where, you know, you have hundreds of thousands of contributors and everything is checked very thoroughly and the quality of it is beyond what any single company or single person could do. But hey, I have things on GitHub where I just throw it onto GitHub and say, it's fine. Nobody's looking at it. So it's okay. So it would be bad for me to judge people if, you know, you just have a hobby project on GitHub and that's fine as well.
Okay. So we briefly spoke about diversity first, but I still want to hear your opinion. And as a community leader, you think diversity initiatives are important, and do you have any tips as someone who's running a community that our listeners can translate into their teams?
I really think diversity is really important. It was one of the things that attracted me to Cloud Native and to Kubernetes in particular, because you know, the Kubernetes community is very, very actively and proudly supports diversity initiatives. And this is a big deal for someone like myself who, I mean, yes, I'm mostly confident in what I do and my own skills, but it's great when you go to an event, to a conference, into a company, and you see other people who are like you. I mean, I worked in that startup. I was the only woman in the office for 2 years, right? And a lot of people would not feel comfortable in that situation. They were lovely to me. They were absolutely fantastic. But still, it is great to be around people where you can really feel you're not the only one, right? So in terms of advice for leaders who, when you say leaders, you're thinking like engineering managers or something else?
Yeah, engineering managers, yeah. CTOs.
Yeah, CTOs. I would say, number one, this doesn't happen by itself. You need to recognize that this takes investment. This can be at the recruiting stage, but especially after the recruiting stage, once you get some people in, it's really important for people to feel like they are recognized and valued as an individual. They're fully supported by the company. And these things, I really wish I could say, like, you know, just do these three things and you'll get diversity. And unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. It's a process that happens throughout the company. It's a question of culture, and it needs to happen all the time. You know, it needs to happen something like, it's not a once a year thing and then you forget about it till next year.
So it's not like a single item you can have on your to-do list. So now I took care of diversity and now I'm done.
Exactly.
<It's> like, obviously.
I think this is actually a little bit disappointing myself, because within the Kubernetes community, there were a lot of really fantastic leaders who are very visible, who are women, who are ethnic minorities, who are LGBTQ, etc. But if you look at the developers who are the open source maintainers, you know, everyone who's ever contributed to Kubernetes or to one of the CNCF projects, that is about 3% women, 3%, right? It's even lower than a technology company like Google, which was probably 18% women. So we've got a long way to go. Honestly, I don't think, it's certainly not a solved problem from my point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from my perspective, it is not solved too. So I think it starts with the moment when you're told as a girl, maybe math is not your biggest strength. And I think it's very, very important to understand that engineering is not about math necessarily. I mean, it can be, but it doesn't have to be. And it's also very important to say that girls are especially math is nothing you have to have like a special strength. And if you're told at your early days that you're not good at it, then this is maybe not too encouraging, right?
I think it's pretty rare nowadays for people to actively say things like, you know, girls are not good at math. Like, I feel like that we're a little bit past now, but I feel like there's a lot of kind of pressure in the environment. As I say, if you go to something when you're a teenage girl and you see you are the only teenage girl there, you know, you get the feeling that this environment is not really supportive of you. And I've had people in my career as well, you know, even after I was a professional software engineer, I mean, when I was 25, maybe, one of the other engineering managers I was very close with, you know, great guy, really nice, really good friend. And he said to me like, oh, Cheryl, you know, you might want to start thinking about how you're going to plan for family and kids in the next few years. And I was like, would you ever have said to a 25-year-old male engineer, think about kids and babies? Like, no 25-year-old guy like starts being told at that age, like, you know, you need to think about kids and family. So there are all these little pressures, all these little moments where people start to think, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to get to this leadership position, or maybe I'm not going to move into this career because people are telling me that it's not for me. I think that's difficult. That's really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you ask yourself, I have a little daughter, by the way, and I sometimes ask myself, so what is it that makes the difference, and why is it that, I don't know, girls wear girls' clothes and you then have colors where girls think this is like a girl's color, and it starts very, very, very early, unfortunately. And yeah, I don't know if it's bad. I think maybe somewhere after that layer, you have to be careful to educate correctly, right?
Yeah, I mean, encourage your daughter and anybody else, any other girls and women, you know, just encourage them to lean into the things that they enjoy doing. So for me, for example, I really enjoyed puzzles as a kid, like number puzzles, word puzzles. I love playing with all of those things. And I think that is what led me into computer science and software engineering, because that's really all it is. It's puzzle solving and problem solving. Mm. And yeah, try and give people as much support as you can. Whenever, now that I run the Cloud Native London meetup group, I encourage women wherever I can to come and speak at the meetup. You know, just give people that little opportunity to do something that they couldn't do before, couldn't do by themselves. And that can mean a lot to their career. It can mean a lot to them. And it's not a big thing that you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks a lot. So I only have two questions left. And one is maybe easy, maybe not. Did you recently discover a nice tool, a nice thing that makes your day so much easier and so much more productive? Can be a process, can be just software. I mean, you're working at the Linux Foundation in a way, that you wanna recommend to everyone, or that you annoy your friends with every once in a while.
Well, let me say, I don't know how recent you call this recently, but there's two things that I discovered during the pandemic. And they're more processes really than tools. One of them is something I have actually done for about 10 years, but I did a lot more this past year, which is journaling. So I write every year for the last 10 years, I've written a document on Google Docs where I write down everything that happened in my work, career, health, relationships, family, you know, all these things. And it really helps you. It really helps me, I think, to get down those ideas onto paper and to really think about it and think about what to do next. The other thing that is very cool, I think, is a open source tool called Anki, which helps you memorize large quantities of information. Again, this tool is not new. It's been around for 20 years, but I'm studying Mandarin Chinese at the moment. And when you study a language, you just have to learn so much vocabulary, so many new sentences and phrases and words. And I've been using Anki every single day for the last year. So for about an hour, half an hour to an hour a day for the last year. And I've seen very big improvements in my language skills over the last year. So highly recommend that.
Okay, cool. Thanks a lot. And then I still have a little surprise for you. So before the podcast, I was just looking up your GitHub profile and also looked into Kubernetes and the early versions of Kubernetes. And I actually found a version which was, I don't know, I think it is a few years ago, and it featured a secret kubectl command called time machine. And this command lets you travel in time. And I just downloaded that old commit And it's now, it disappeared actually from Kubernetes, and still install it, and I can fire it up now. I type in kubectl time machine 2015. And that is actually the time when you were working as a technical program manager at Google in London. And we now see us traveling back in time and see yourself working at Google, coding a bit, doing project management, program management. And you now have the chance to whisper something into your ears back then. What would it be?
Wow, that is a great question. I guess I would say, buy Apple stock. Let's pretend.
Buy
Google stock, buy or Bitcoin. Amazon stock, whatever. Buy Bitcoin, exactly. Here's the lottery numbers. I would say that the thing that I've learned most over the last few years is how important it is to give opportunities to other people. So the further you get in your career and the more success that you see for yourself individually, the more you should spread that around, the more you should bring in other people and get other people, especially when they're early in their career or if they're not very confident yet, give those people a small nudge. You know, give them that little opportunity to present at a meetup or to bring them into a community, an open source community that they haven't seen before. And those little things are very meaningful for people. Yeah, that's what I would say to myself. Do more of that.
It's a great answer as well. So thanks a lot, Xiao, for being on the podcast. And I'm very happy. It was great talking to you, and looking forward to maybe meeting you at a certain time when it's allowed again, when it's possible again. Looking forward to see what happens at CNCF in the future.
I've really enjoyed talking to you as well, Toby. So thank you so much for having me on as a guest.
Bye-bye.
Bye.